Well, the Fortune 500 list just came out, and guess who was at the top? ExxonMobil is bigger than Walmart again. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we're going to look inside our largest corporation and try to probe the motivations for why it operates in Alaska the way it does. Our phone number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, that's a local call at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Our guest, journalist Steve Call, who knows plenty about ExxonMobil and is here to talk with you on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So it was 23 years ago on the 25th of March, 1989, that I climbed aboard a small plane with a few others headed out of Anchorage for Valdez, because the tanker, Exxon Valdez, had hit Bly Reef and was leaking some oil. My conversations aboard that plane stand out in my memory. They were a prelude to one of the most challenging assignments of my broadcast journalism career. We're lucky it was Exxon, I was told. It would have been much worse if it was one of the others. Exxon is among the best of them. Well, the company was among the best of them, but that didn't stop it from becoming one of the most hated corporate entities in the world. Certainly the most hated corporation in Alaska. And to this day, on C Street and 34th Avenue in Anchorage, there is no sign in front of the building where ExxonMobil's Alaska headquarters is located. They took that sign down 23 years ago. They never put it back up. And that is going to be no surprise to our guest on today's program, Steve Call. He has spent years researching ExxonMobil. He's done hundreds of interviews, and his book about the corporation just came out. It is 624 pages, full of one story after another, that spell out the forces inside ExxonMobil that make it the force that it is. Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. It's our subject on Talk of Alaska today. Now, you may have heard Steve Call on other venues. He's making the circuit, promoting his book, and people are avidly interested in this story that he tells. And it's because of that that we can't get him right here at the top of the hour. He has to come on a little bit later because he's just finishing up another interview at the studios of San Francisco public radio station KALW. And so they basically have to disconnect with that interview and then hook him up for this interview here, which we'll be doing on Talk of Alaska. He'll be on live. It will be a digital link, so he'll be virtual. It will sound as if he's in the room with us, but he's actually in San Francisco. Our weather might be a little better. I'm not sure. Anyway, so that's what will be happening in the program today. You can be thinking about what you would like to discuss with Steve Call. Maybe you've heard him on other shows and you've got some idea of some of the revelations in this book. They come pretty fast and thick. And, you know, there's 624 pages of it. I got the book less than a week ago and have made my way, I don't know, about a third of the way through it. And I'm certainly going to finish it. But there's a lot to absorb there. And fortunately, it starts right out with the Exxon Valdez and all that sort of thing. So that's the way the book starts. And then the results of that for the corporate culture of Exxon, which were severe, as we're going to hear as the show goes on. So Steve Call is the author of a number of other books besides Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. And they include Ghost Wars, which those who have read tell me is excellent. The Bin Ladens, which is well known, was a huge bestseller. He is a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. He is president of the New American Foundation. and he is a 20-year veteran of the Washington Post, where back in 1990, he won a Pulitzer Prize. And he's with us now by digital link. Steve Call, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm so glad to have you. So what were you doing when the Exxon Valdez hit the rocks?
What was I doing? I was reporting in New York City on Wall Street corruption at that time, just getting ready to go abroad as a reporter for The Washington Post.
Well, I remember because it happened on a weekend that my boss called me and I said, don't worry, they'll have it cleaned up by Monday. It didn't turn out that way. And that's how you open the book. You give a very, trim account of the Exxon Valdez disaster. I guess I call it a disaster. But then you also go on to say about what it did to the corporate culture of Exxon. Now, we're dealing with a corporation that is fairly regimented up till then. Is it fair to say that it became even more regimented and perhaps even obsessed with safety?
Yeah, it really did. And they, they were traumatized and shocked themselves by the scale of the disaster. They lost their what reputation they had with the public, disappeared overnight, and they were already being governed by men, particularly this rising executive Lee Raymond, who wanted to remake the company, and they used the crisis of the Valdez accident to do that. And one of the ways they went after reform and change was to instill these global systems of automation and safety and almost obsessive focus on the conduct of every sort of operation over the course of a day. They basically tried to make the system idiot-proof to wring out human error, human fallibility from drilling and shipping and transportation through pipelines to the greatest extent humanly possible. And that meant writing everything down and binding it all up into a system. And if you went to work there, you got these huge binders telling you how to do everything. And you were reprimanded if you deviated from the manual, and you were held accountable for your performance. And safety became a focus, and they did develop the best safety record among the major oil companies over the next 15 years or so.
And they got a slogan, nobody gets hurt.
Yeah, it's on the signs and the billboards all over the world. I traveled all over the place to do this book, and they have the same look and feel everywhere. It doesn't matter whether you're in southern Chad or Equatorial Guinea or Indonesia. All their compounds have the same fencing, the same security lights, the same gates, and they all have a similar billboard at the front, and often the slogan on it says, nobody gets hurt.
Having gone through the Exxon Valdez so many years ago, I guess I have some, negative impressions of the corporation. And reading your book really kind of shows me that they're not exactly the bad guys that I was thinking them to be, that there's kind of reasons for the way that they, for them being the way they are.
Well, the rigidity they would describe as necessary to keep people safe and to prevent accidents like the Valdez from recurring. And, I think that's fair enough. You go to work on one of their oil platforms, you're putting your life at risk. These are very dangerous industrial sort of settings, and anyone would want the company that they work at or have a loved one working at to, to be focused on getting home safely each day. And ExxonMobil's attitude was that, well, after the Valdez, we discovered that in order to be safe, we had to think about this all day long and much more carefully than we had been doing before. And their best practices have spread around the industry and probably over time saved lives. So that's good. But the problem is that their rigidity and their insularity extends to everything they do. It extends to their political strategy, the way they communicate with the public, the way they think about threats to their business. They don't have the windows open. They're not looking for new ideas. And some of the way that they operate in Washington and around the world, they're basically a government that isn't really accountable to anyone but their shareholders. And they exercise an enormous amount of power for the purpose simply of advancing their own business interests, which, under law, they're entitled to do. But we look at them as the public, and we think maybe they ought to do more than just pursue their self-interest.
Are you old enough to remember the anti-conformity thing that started happening in the 1950s with the Organization Man and things like that, where they started pointing to this sort of regimented corporate mentality as obsolete and uncreative and so forth like that? I'm talking about the 50s now.
Yeah. No, it's been around a long time. And you know, ExxonMobil's outlasted it all because,
yeah.
Of course, the oil business is pretty forgiving, though. I mean, if you can operate reasonably well in this business and you've got scale, you know, you can make money whether you're good, bad, or indifferent at it. But yeah, and they it's interesting, you know, when people call them out on some of these habits of theirs, their insularity, and they'll say things like, well, these values are old-fashioned, we recognize, and they're out of fashion now, but we think they're enduring and so forth. But I think, you know, the strategic question they face is, you look at, they're a technology company in a lot of ways. They're a science company. They need the very best scientists. They need the very best engineers. You look at the United States and where the best talented scientists and engineers are, who they're going to be 30 or 40 years from now. A lot more of them are going to be women than is the case now. We have a very diverse country. We live in a very diverse world. You know, can they really maintain this very closed system and attract and retain the very talented, creative people that they're going to need? I'm not so sure about that.
Well, we're speaking with Steve Coll, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. He's joining us by digital link from San Francisco, and it's great to have you with us. And, you know, Steve, you have kind of the most fun beat these days. I mean, I try to make my beat science, but business is running a close second these days because it's so interesting.
Yeah. Well, these companies are just interesting places. They all have their own culture and their own mission. They've got a lot of problems. And from a journalist's perspective, what was rewarding about this book project was to realize that this was pretty much uncharted territory. Normally, when you go to report on the government, if you're at the governor's house you're reporting on the governor, or you're reporting on a campaign, or you're reporting on the Pentagon, there are dozens and dozens of very capable professional reporters working alongside you trying to get to the bottom of things. And in the case of ExxonMobil, I mean, here's this enormous force in our society. Its revenues are greater than the size of the economy in most countries in the world. They're the largest corporation headquartered in the United States. And there are reporters who cover them as a business story and do a good job. But as a general matter, they escape scrutiny. No one really tries to get behind their wall, and they keep their walls high and their doors locked. And so it was exciting to work on something where you were pretty much on your own.
Did you interview Lee Raymond, or who did that interview?
I did. I did interview him.
How did you manage to get his get him to agree to that? He must have known the depth of research you were doing.
Yeah, maybe that's a reason why he agreed. I mean, I think. You know, he's a man who accomplished a lot in the industry. Within the industry, he's regarded as, you know, the most successful chief executive of his generation. He's now in his 70s. He's well retired. And he probably, I don't know how people make these kinds of decisions, but I was grateful that he did. He was a very good interview subject in the sense that he's what a writer always wants from a subject, which is he's comfortable in his own skin. He doesn't dissemble. He tells you what he thinks. He's very direct. And I would imagine if I were him, I might have made a similar decision in the sense that how many books about him are going to be written before he's gone? And here's a chance to at least put his two cents in if he believes, as he should have, that I would treat him honestly, then why not get his side of the story across? He had a kind of fearsome reputation, and he was tough on his employees. A lot of people felt very bruised by his management style. He could be quite abusive, frankly. But I would imagine that he wouldn't have wanted other people to control his story entirely. He could contribute to it by cooperating, and he did.
Talking to my oil patch friends here, none of whom actually work for Exxon, but some of whom have had association with them in the past and said, I wouldn't want to work for them because they're too regimented. You got everything's by the book. And sure, the money is great, but at the same time, are you ever really able to be yourself when you're doing this job? Well, I guess Lee Raymond, in a way, really was. You know, here's an engineer. He comes up through the ranks, and he's running the corporation, and he's running it very well. It's making money year after year. It's building its reserves year after year. What's to complain about? You know, it worked okay. Yeah. It works okay for the guy on top.
Yeah, well, I think that's the point. And it's quite a struggle to get there. And I have the same feeling as your friends, which is, you know, you can respect and admire aspects of their sort of achievements in discipline and internal sort of regimented approaches, but that doesn't mean you'd want to work there. And the compensation is good, and I guess by industry standards, you know, if you were thinking about making a lateral move to ExxonMobil and you're well qualified, you kind of have to go in early because they don't take people generally at the top of their careers. But you know, they pay well. But the main thing that they offer is, if you pass through their review systems, you're there for life. I mean, they're the last intact company town really in the United States. And if you're willing to move every 3 years and you're willing to go by the book and you're willing to sacrifice your kind of creative improvisation at the workplace and just, do what they ask you to do, you'll retire very comfortably and you'll have job security for your whole life. And we know, looking out of this country, that's still appealing for obvious reasons.
So Lee Raymond is retired. Rex Tillerson is in charge. And I've not got to that part of the book yet, Steve Call. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about whether there's been a change in the corporate outlook and its view towards the future under new management.
Yeah, it's interesting. So Lee Raymond retired in the end of 2005, and I think the board, looking at the question of succession, had in mind a couple of things at the same time. One was, well, this ain't broke, so let's not get someone who's going to try to fix it because we're doing very, very well. We're making a lot of money. And Lee Raymond presided over a system that was bigger than himself. And so the idea was, let's have continuity. Let's have someone who will keep the system going, who understands the system. And Rex Tillerson had been, at the very top around Lee Raymond for years before he was chosen. But the other objective that the board had was, we need to tell our story a little better. We can still make a lot of money while being hated and being unpopular, but surely we can do better in communicating what we think are our merits and the positive things that we do. So let's pick someone who can communicate better. And that was part of the case for Rex Tillerson. He grew up in Texas. His father was a Boy Scout administrator, lower middle class family. That grew up in the post-war period. He went to the University of Texas, was an engineer, joined out of college, typical ExxonMobil life story, rose through the ranks. He's a very affable guy, very comfortable communicator. And so when he came in, he did two things. One was he kept everything going as it was, but he also tried to tell a different story about ExxonMobil. And for the first 5 years, up until about 2010, I would say he did not strike out in any new strategic directions. He tried to talk about ExxonMobil in a new way, but he didn't really do anything much differently. Until two things. He, in 2009, agreed that the risks of global warming were serious enough to warrant a carbon tax. That was a big change from where ExxonMobil had been before. And then more materially to shareholders, he made a big bet on natural gas onshore in the United States, and he bought the leading producer of unconventional gas, XTO, in 2010. Now ExxonMobil is America's leading producer of unconventional gas, the so-called fracking gas. That's his big strategic bet. And there's some controversy about it among analysts. Did he buy into this at the top of the market? Did he overpay? Our low gas prices?
Right, that's just what I was thinking. Yeah.
He's received some criticism. But, ExxonMobil's answer is, well, look, we buy these properties with 30 or 40 years in mind. We know how to get value out of them that other people can't. So be patient, and who knows what gas prices, natural gas prices in the continental United States will be 10 years from now. I don't.
I think we have to say this is a company that's really good at what it does. You know, these people are management comes out of the ranks. They know what it's like down below. They know what the oil patch is like, and they manage things in a realistic fashion. And what's amazing is that when it gets to the political arena, they don't do too bad there either. You know,
well, they
even
get their way and
pushing around other countries.
Yeah, but it's interesting. There's a sort of a debate about that. I mean, you're right. I mean, the record is what it is. They are very successful in the ways that you describe. But politically, I wonder if their model isn't kind of running out of time in the world that we're in, not just because of the sort of question of who they can recruit and retain to keep themselves fresh and on the edge of science, as we were talking about before, but also with foreign governments. I mean, they're seen within the business as bad partners. They're very prickly as partners. They want to do everything themselves, and they're seen by their competitors as arrogant. They're like the New York Yankees or the Dallas Cowboys. You know, they're the evil empire. And
those are very apt comparisons there.
So they're easy to dislike in that way, and they wear it with pride, almost like the Yankees and the Cowboys do. You know, they kind of go around looking the same, white shirts and red ties and blue suits and short hair, and they cluster together. They don't communicate very well, and the question is, I mean, there's a lot of their competitors. What their competitors will say is, you know, that world is gone. You can't just go around and kick people in the shins anymore and expect them to do what you want. This is a world of partnerships. It's a world of economic integration. It's a world of sharing, of collaboration. And, you know, the European companies and Chevron will say, we get that. They don't. But at what point can you really look at the evidence so far and say, well, it's showing up in their business results? I'm not sure that it has shown up in their business results. They do seem to get forward doing it the way they do it, even if other people don't like it.
Well, Steve Call, I want to get down to some Alaska stuff and see if you have some light you could shed on some of the Exxon issues in Alaska here. But first, I'd like you to meet some Alaskans who are calling in and want to talk with you. Are you ready for that?
Sure.
All right. From out in White Mountain, which is near Nome, this is Roger. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roger, with Steve Call.
Oh, good morning, Talk Alaska personnel and listeners. I got a question and a comment. Since the conception of Exxon Corporation, do you have any idea of how many barrels of oil they pumped and what was the total value of said oil?
Okay, Roger. Hang on here. Let's see if Steve has any kind of answer for that. Does anybody have that answer?
Well, ExxonMobil produces 4.5 million barrels of oil equivalent, oil and gas a day, currently. So that would make them smaller than Saudi Arabia on the world stage, but you know, bigger than a fair number of places. And 4.5 million barrels a day times 365 days, you can figure out they pump and sell that much each year. So they've got to find a field, in effect, of 1.5 billion barrels once a year just to replace what they've produced.
We'll get back to that reserve question, too, because I think that's really fascinating and really at the core of the narrative. But I think what Roger has in mind is ever since John D. Rockefeller, how much actual oil has somehow been
produced all those years?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be an interesting number to calculate. Well, right. you can do a rough guess, basically. So let's say 90 years, 100 years, times, you know, no more than, I mean, some years they were producing 7 or 8 million barrels a day. So we can say more than 100 billion barrels, I think, with some confidence, but I'd have to go back and do the math.
Okay, Roger, back to you.
That was my question and my comment. You answered it very well.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call from out there at White Mountain. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. From Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Remember that. And the email is talk@alaskapublic.org, where we have a stack of them already come in. The guest is Steve Call, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. And, Steve, let me ask you this. In Alaska, the corporate culture of ExxonMobil has been, since the spill, almost totally underground. The only time that they have come out is when the state threatened to take away some of its leases at Point Thompson. This is a gas deposit, but there's no pipeline to it. And they kind of were smoked out on that. And then they got involved in the gas line bidding system, basically, where the other two big companies up here, BP and ConocoPhillips, combined to study a gas line. And Exxon chose to ally itself instead with the winner of the state bidding process for a gas line to the lower 48, TransCanada. So those are all, the only two things, really, where we see them. They're a large producer here. They're a large owner of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, but they're completely quiet in that context.
Yeah, what's interesting, obviously you and your listeners know a lot more about Alaska than I do, but I did try to understand their attitude, ExxonMobil's attitude towards Alaska at different points, and the gas piece of it was probably the most important thing. You know, ExxonMobil sort of has this attitude that they want low political risk and high political stability. That suits their very, you know, very rigid, long-term business model. And they regard Alaska as a place that they just can't seem to figure out politically. And they often talk about Alaska the way they talk about, you know, other political environments that they just can't seem to manage. Now, this gas economy that we're moving into, the world of both the potential to export liquefied natural gas, you know, potentially from Alaskan supplies and other supplies, as well as the shift that seems to be underway to emphasize gas consumption for power generation in the lower 48 and for other purposes, all this seems maybe to finally be cracking that code if that pipeline can sort of come together in a sort of politically stable way. It would be a big change, both for Alaska and for the American energy economy, I think.
Well, I've been up here for a long time, and it's pretty hard for me to figure out the political volatility of the state of Alaska. I will say, Wally,
you seem to be an independent-minded people who are hard for other people to predict.
Right, but I would have to say that Wally Hickel ain't no Hugo Chavez, let me put it that way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we do live in a system of property rights still in this country.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. And our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. And from Alexander Creek, Don would like to know why Exxon isn't putting more energy into harnessing the energy of the sun. And you explain that pretty well in a book. They tried. They didn't like it.
Exactly. They didn't think it made business sense to them, and their sort of attitude is that they don't want to be in any business that requires a government subsidy to be profitable. That was one way they saw solar. But also they do this forecast every year where they look out over the next 30 or 40 years and try to forecast energy demand. They don't believe that they can accurately forecast prices, but they do believe they can forecast demand for different sectors of energy. And when they look at solar power and its potential growth path, they see it growing quickly relative to a very small starting point, but they don't really see it threatening the oil industry or the natural gas industry anytime soon, and they don't really see a business for themselves right now. And more generally, talking about the kind of attitude of the corporation that we've touched on a few times, Lee Raymond, in particular, was very direct in saying, we're oil and gas purists. He told his colleagues he wanted to emblazon on the headquarters in Granite the words crude oil. Let's not try to fool anybody into thinking we're anything different. Let's concentrate on that and do it better than anybody else. And that still, I think, is their operating philosophy. They have their eyes sort of open. Is there some transformational fuel that could come along that they could scale up to the level of a global system of the sort they operate now for oil and gas? You know, in theory, they'd be open to that, I suppose, but they don't actually see anything of that character. So they basically stay away from the alternative energy sources.
We're speaking with Steve Call, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
ExxonMobil, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. The author with us today by digital link on Talk of Alaska to talk with you. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. So maybe this is the point, Steve Call, where we could go into the reserve equation. A corporation the size of ExxonMobil is producing, as you have pointed out, a colossal amount of product every day. And if its stock price is not to go down, somehow it has to show on its books that it can continue doing that. It seems to me like there comes a point where they won't be able to do that anymore.
Well, it's they're definitely struggling over the last 10 or 15 years to stay even. You know, they benefited from the oil sands in Canada, which they counted as part of their reserve replacement each year, even though the Securities and Exchange Commission said they shouldn't be including it in their counting. And so they changed the rule in order to make it easier for them to claim that they were replacing how much they produced each year. But, you know, the bigger picture is there's enough oil and gas in the world for them to replace what they produce each year. It's just that it's not accessible to a company like ExxonMobil very easily, because most of the easy oil and gas is in the Middle East, where resource nationalism and state oil companies lock ExxonMobil out from owning it. So it makes it harder and harder for them to find places where they can bring online fields, you know, of the scale that are required each year. Direction they've clearly struck out in to address that problem is that they're emphasizing natural gas over oil, because it's easier to find natural gas at the moment. And while it may be less profitable on a barrel per barrel basis to produce gas as opposed to oil, which is still the most profitable source of energy that they produce, they don't have any choice. So their mix of holdings has shifted gradually toward gas, and I think it's now about 50-50, maybe ticking a little above 50%, and that probably is going to continue to grow. So at least they can say, you know, on an oil equivalent basis, which is the way they measure these things, they're holding their own, but the portfolio is shifting in the direction of gas, and that may not be as profitable a business over 30 years as oil was over the last 30.
Steve Call, as a business writer, the price of natural gas is way lower than anybody thought it would be. And because of new supplies coming on, it seems like it's going to stay down for a while, at least until there's a lot of power plant conversion or something to drive that price up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really struck by the structural change in demand potentially for natural gas in the United States. I mean, if it stays cheap, it will change potentially the cost of manufacturing in the lower 48. I mean, you've got, you know, natural gas is a feedstock for so much industrial activity, and if it stays cheap for a long time, there's going to be a lot of demand for it in that respect. But, you know, I'm not a commodities economist, but when I talk to commodities economists, they basically all say one thing, which is that in the world of commodities, you get these cycles, and when there's too much supply and the price falls, then the market over time reduces supply and the price goes back up again. And when it goes back up again, people bring supply online and it goes down again. And so this undulating pattern is certainly true if you account for inflation in the history of oil prices. And gas has always been different because it's been so regional. But now maybe we'll get a little bit more of a pattern of up and down over the next 20 or 30 years. But I'm just channeling what the economists tell me. I don't really have a confident, independent view about the future of natural gas prices at all.
Yeah, my natural gas friends tell me the problem with the price of natural gas is that the demand is very inflexible. It can't grow very fast because somebody actually has to send a new pipe to somewhere to and get it consumed in some way, and that just never happens very fast. So I don't
know. That makes good sense. That makes good sense. And oil is different that way. It's very, you know, it's very, the very fact that it's a liquid and that's easy to move around makes it easier for these cycles to kind of come into equilibrium.
Yeah. Well, obviously we need to talk about the Alaska-Canada gas line project, which seems comatose at the moment. Let's go to Bob in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. A great show. I'm intrigued with the subject matter. My name is Bob Breen. I'm originally from Tanacross, and I represent four village corporations on the Alaska Highway at the eastern border with Canada. We own approximately 100 miles of right-of-way for that proposed project, and we found over time that our inability to deal with ExxonMobil and that they just didn't seem to want to budge from their corporate culture, even when it came to recognizing Indigenous people's ownership of right-of-way. And in fact, they are still trying to broker a land exchange with the Tetlin Wildlife Refuge, despite Title 11 of ANILCA, which is national law. And I was just wondering if your guest had any comments or observations about ExxonMobil's willingness to cooperate with local landowners or Indigenous groups, or lack of willingness due to corporate culture.
Bob, you're going to want to read this book, let me tell you, because that's not going to be any surprise. It's no surprise to you, is it, Steve Call?
No, it's not. And it was interesting, their community relations and political engagement strategy is subject to the same kind of universal playbook, universal manual that all of their industrial operations are subject to. So if you're a community relations or a political relations officer for ExxonMobil, wherever you are, whether it's in Alaska or Aceh, Indonesia, or West Africa, you have the same set of instructions for how to carry out your job and who to engage with and what to offer them. When I was in Africa, I was really struck because Exxon acquired a lot of Mobil's properties there only in 2000. And when I talked to Africans in these countries, they all said, oh, we really miss Mobil because they were so flexible. You know, we'd have a problem, we could actually talk to them. They would allow us to fly on their planes, and we had a real set of relationships. And when Exxon came in, everything was by the book, and we could never seem to get, like, a human conversation going around the issues as we saw them. So I'm not surprised to hear that in your Alaskan setting.
Anything else, Bob?
Well, I appreciate the comment. I just, we have national laws in Alaska, such as the passage of ANCSA and the ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Act, that really, you know, dictate that there is a different way of doing business up here. But it seems that their corporate culture is looking for ways around those laws rather than working with people in a project that might be beneficial to everybody involved.
Thanks, Bob. And I think, the book, if you read the book on that, it's quite clear that the corporation has frequently gone right to the top to try and get the power to get things that it needs. And that certainly was true, wouldn't you say, Steve Call, of the relationship between Lee Raymond and Dick Cheney?
Yeah, that was an unusual relationship because it was a friendship that went back well before Cheney became vice president. When he was running Halliburton, he and Lee Raymond were neighbors in Dallas and friends, and their wives became friends, and they really did. They were similar characters. They both had grew up in the Midwest, and they were very sort of quiet, reticent, but also sort of hard-boiled global oil men, and they seemed to share the same outlook on the world. They went hunting together, and so when Cheney became vice president, I mean, Raymond could go to Washington and have private conversations with him as you would with a friend, and they would talk about world oil politics or what was happening in Saudi Arabia or what was happening in Kazakhstan and trade insights and information. And every now and then, when Raymond felt frustrated that the United States government wasn't doing enough to help ExxonMobil in some deal or competition or another, he would call on Cheney and ask him to intervene personally to get around the State Department or that sort of thing. And there's some examples described in the book about how that happened. You know, at the same time, the opposite was also true. ExxonMobil really, you know, it asked the Bush administration to help when it wanted the Bush administration's help, and at other times it would just go its own way and undermine the Bush administration's foreign policy in some countries. I mean, human rights is an example. They didn't want anything to do with the Bush administration's democracy promotion and human rights campaigning in some of the dictatorships where they produced oil in West Africa, because that would just make their host government uncomfortable with them. And there's a great scene where the Indian prime minister is visiting with President Bush, George W. Bush, and he's trying to get ExxonMobil to do something in a Russian oil deal where they're partners. And Bush just turns to him and says, you know, nobody tells these guys what to do. So even if the president of the United States has that attitude, I guess it says something about the corporate culture.
I know them from the oil patch. And I can tell you right now. I can hear him saying it. Well, Steve Cull is our guest, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. And before I go to the call from Eno Cleet, maybe just dipping into this. One of the things that amuses me the most so far in the book is the confrontation in the strategy game between Greenpeace and Exxon with regards to climate warming. Because it seems that at one point Greenpeace adopts a strategy, let's make Exxon such a bad guy, no other oil company wants to be like them. And at the same time, what you have with Exxon is a lavish amount of spending to back their case that humans are not responsible for the climate warming, to promote doubt, but always trying to stay on the other side of that liability line that got the tobacco industry, which they seem to always have been very aware that you there was a line you couldn't cross or people could sue you.
Right, exactly. You got it. And yeah, the two institutions, Greenpeace and ExxonMobil, they're both very sophisticated at what they do, and they're both hardball players in a way. You know, they're not compromisers. And so it was a very interesting contest. I have to say, you know, at the end of the day, across 7 or 8 years, Greenpeace achieved its objectives in that they did sully ExxonMobil's reputation and almost forced them into a changed position on climate change, because they raised the cost of ExxonMobil's defiance in terms of its reputation with shareholders and mutual fund managers and other constituents. But ExxonMobil got its way, too, because the policy didn't change. And so they've maybe paid a price for the way. And also, the public did develop doubts about climate science that seem really divorced from what mainstream climate scientists say is the science. So, you know, maybe they achieved their objective, too. And then finally, as you point out, they have not yet been held accountable for liability and may never be. And so in that sense, maybe they did toe that line. The difference between them and the tobacco companies on this issue is a critical one, and that is that we do know from the records now that the tobacco industries, inside their own laboratories and with their own scientists, they had lots of evidence early, like in the 50s and 60s, that smoking was very dangerous to human health, but they suppressed it. They deliberately covered it up so they could sell more cigarettes. Well, there's nothing comparable on the record about ExxonMobil and global warming. This science was young. It's a complicated science. It was disputed, even if the consensus was growing rapidly year by year after the 1990s. And so there's no evidence that they knew what they were saying was false. And that's the basis for a liability finding, I would think, in their case. Anyway, they've gotten out of their own way now, and they concede that the risks of global warming are serious enough to warrant, you know, a price on carbon-based fuels, for example. That's a big change for them.
Well, I wonder if they'll ever come around to making some of their reserves being something other than fossil fuels.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're moving to natural gas, which I think they're doing mostly because of the reserve replacement problem that we were talking about earlier. That does also give them a little better story to tell on climate, because natural gas, at least in its cleanest forms of production, obviously produces less greenhouse gas emissions than oil typically does.
Yeah, actually, if methane is already popping out of the earth and you burn it, it's less damaging than it was when it was methane.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go to Joanne, joins the program from Unalakleet. Joanne, you're on live with Steve Call.
Yes, good morning. I just had two questions and then I'll hang up. The first is, I am wondering what happened to the captain who was in charge of the Exxon. And then the second is, I am wondering how much money did Exxon put out for cleanup after the spill? And I'll just go ahead and listen right now.
Joanne, thanks for those questions. They're both great. Joe Hazelwood is no longer with the company.
No, he was fired by ExxonMobil a few weeks afterwards because of evidence that he had been drinking before he boarded the ship that night. And, of course, he had a record of arrests for driving while intoxicated that Exxon had tolerated and had not done much to intervene about. The last reports that I've seen of Mr. Hazelwood have him saying that he hasn't had a drink since that night. He's sober and he's living, I believe, in the New York area. Last report, working for a marine insurance company providing analysis or some sort of professional services in the marine insurance industry. He's a very interesting character, a very intelligent man who had his whole world obviously turned upside down that night.
He didn't let you interview him, did he?
No, I didn't.
He rarely.
He doesn't. He's given a couple of very revealing interviews, and of course, he testified in some of those trials. On the cleanup number, I'm trying to remember what Exxon said. I think they claimed that they spent maybe as much as $5 billion on cleanup, but you know, they get to count their own numbers, and so I don't really know.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's definitely more than three.
Estimated it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely more than three, and we still have the reopener hanging around there with 100 million. But boy, they're fighting that. And this once again is the Exxon culture. You know, we don't lose lawsuits.
Right, exactly. Sue us and we'll burn your house down.
Right. Our guest is Steve Call as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about ExxonMobil with Steve Call, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and the American Power. And Steve has done a lot of interviews and research into this corporation. A question from Bob by email, who says, wait a minute, are we sure this is unprecedented power? Is there anything different between this and, say, the British East India Company, the old Standard Oil Company that this is a part of, or the Hudson Bay Company? Isn't it always kind of the same thing where a company gets market dominance and does everything it can to control its markets, production, everything else they can?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a fair comment. I would choose sort of East India as maybe a little closer to this. I mean, Standard Oil was an enormously powerful corporation at the turn of the century, more powerful relative to the United States economy than ExxonMobil is today. But America's role in the world was much quieter and less decisive than it is now. What interests me about ExxonMobil in its global reach and size and influence in the places where it operates is how it also connects to this moment of American hegemony around the world. And in that sense, it's a little bit more like the East India Company of the British era, because in that era you had both a very powerful British state with global ambitions, and then you had a British headquartered company that was semi-independent of the British state had saw its interests differently, but also had global influence. And that, in a very broad strokes comparison, is similar to the way I see ExxonMobil now. And I think it's fair enough to say, look, this is not the only corporation in the world of this type. It's not the only corporation of this type headquartered in the United States. But if you compare ExxonMobil's global power to, say, Google or Walmart, which are two also very powerful global corporations, the one difference is that ExxonMobil's business model requires them to go out into the world and basically drill holes in the ground and sit on top of those holes for up to 30, 40 years at a time. And that puts them into a political role in the countries where they're trying to realize the value from the holes they drill. That's different from a retailing company or an information company. So I think they're kind of a throwback in their global role to the East India era, but you have to be careful with these kinds of historical comparisons. Maybe directionally they're suggestive, but I wouldn't take it too far.
Yeah, and our communications are so different nowadays. Okay, here's one. Do you know what they have to do in order to book reserves? I'm wondering, for instance, how it stands with Point Thompson. It's a big resource, but it's not connected to anything. So they've filed a plan with the state where they basically want to cycle this natural gas out. They say it's a very high pressure field, and they'll take the liquids, you know, the propane and things like that, the fractions out of it, and sell those. Do they get to book that now as a reserve, that whole deposit? Because it's a pretty big deposit.
Yeah, I mean, their lawyers advised them about this, and basically the answer has to do with very detailed Securities and Exchange Commission rules, which are then interpreted kind of back and forth between the company lawyers and the commission lawyers as to exactly how ExxonMobil is making its decisions this way. I think the corporation basically has room to decide for itself what it wishes to declare as booked, but the SEC rules say that a holding has to be economically viable in some way. I forget exactly the language, but it has to be plausible commercially in a finite period of time. And so the absence of a distribution system is a factor in whether or not you can book something. If you really can't sell it, then you can't book it. So
well, did they roll the SEC on the issue of the tar sands?
They did, yeah. Well, they rolled the public more than they rolled the SEC. They complied with the fine print of the SEC's rule. So the SEC's rule was you cannot account for tar sands as booked reserves because they're a form of mining in the SEC's view. And the SEC, their job is to protect the investing public, and particularly with small fly-by-night companies, they're trying to raise money on stock markets. They want investors to have reliable information about what these companies actually own and what they don't own. And so they have rules. And one of the rules was you can't count as oil something that you basically mine. And the SEC's judgment was that the Canadian sands were a mining activity. And they very explicitly said you can't count it. So ExxonMobil basically just went ahead and issued press releases each year saying, we've replaced 100% of our reserves, and the claim was based on the fact that they had oil sands in those numbers, even though the SEC told them they shouldn't count them. And they just said, we don't think the SEC's rules reflect reality. The reality, this is oil, we own it, and so we're declaring that we've replaced 100% of our reserves. And then in their filings to the SEC, to stay on the right side of the law, they would have a little kind of asterisk section that would break out separately the amount that was actually oil sands as opposed to SEC counted oil.
I gotta say, that is totally eye popping. It's just plain eye popping.
Yeah. They declare it and say, you know, who's gonna challenge us?
Ron in Fairbanks, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Steve Call.
Thanks. Because of your research and insight, what do you think Alaskans in particular particularly our elected officials should know regarding public policy when they're dealing with a corporation like ExxonMobil?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think ExxonMobil, first of all, deals with state governments out of a very specific playbook, which is probably knowable in some broad sense to those governments. And the playbook basically describes what ExxonMobil's corporate position is about any issue in public policy that might matter to Alaskan elected officials. There's literally a black binder on the shelf of the Vice President of Public Affairs at ExxonMobil that describes exactly what ExxonMobil's position is about, you know, trans-Alaskan gas pipelines or environmental policy at the state level or whatever issue it might be.
It's no secret at all.
and when they come to the meeting, I mean, they're going to follow that playbook and they're not going to negotiate off of it. That's the thing you have to understand. They are fixed in their position. And you can you can listen to them and understand what their position is, but you're not going to change their position. If they change their position on a matter of public policy that's important to them, it will be over a period of years after total review by the board of directors and the chief executive and others. So, you know, when they seem like they're fixed and unmovable and stiff in their negotiating position with public officials, it's because they are. That's the way they do things.
Ron?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. This one comes from Bruce, who says, one of the techniques oil spillers try to do is surmise there was and already is other oil on the spill site, so a little more is of no consequence. This happened at Prince William Sound, of course, Gulf of Mexico, and will in the future. Due to substantial funding of bad science by the oil industry, tobacco science is alive and well in the oil industry.
Yeah, you know, the thing about their approach to those spill science disputes, and there was a big one still running around the reopener that you referred to before in Prince William Sound, is that, you know, the thing that they do again and again, it seemed to me, is they basically approach the science as lawyers would, not as scientists would. So they basically get their litigators into the picture early, and they figure out, you know, how to construct an argument that is most favorable to ExxonMobil around the available facts. You know, let's attribute to them good faith and say they don't make anything up. But they basically let their lawyers decide how to approach some of the scientific controversies. Whereas scientists, you know, they would approach these questions in a very different way, open-minded, sharing data, talking to each other, arguing, journey of discovery, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, scientists wants to be proven wrong. They love it.
Yeah, yeah. But the legal mentality is almost the opposite of that.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Steve Call.
Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
It's been, I admire your endurance almost as much as your diligence.
Thanks a lot.
Are you gonna? How long do you keep touring on this one?
Oh, I'm afraid I'm on the road for a month or so.
Okay.
Around the United States. Yeah.
I hope you get some well-deserved rest. And thanks for joining us. Thanks also to radio station KALW. Thanks Josh Edge and Kristen Spock and Dave Waldron.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.